Welcome to the Humble Hoof Podcast. My name is Alicia Harlov. This is a podcast for both horse owners and hoof care professionals, offering discussions into various philosophies on the health of the hoof and soundness of your horse. Please check us out on Facebook or at thehumblehoof.com. About 6 years ago, I had Stephen Lee on the podcast talking about movement and self-trimming and navicular cases and hoof rehab and all the cool things that we see when it comes to horses with hoof issues and how we can get them better. I have been thinking about that conversation probably for the last 6 years, so I reached out to Stephen to see if he would talk to me again, this time about some navicular cases. Well, thank you so much for being willing to hop on a call again.
It's all right. It's only been 6 years, hasn't it? It's surprising where time goes.
I know. It's crazy. I can't even believe that. Well, I mean, first of all, COVID messed up my entire idea of time because I can't even believe that it's been that long since I've even had a podcast. But yeah, well, awesome. So yeah, why don't we just start if you want to talk a little bit about, you know, what you're doing now in the hoof care world and what area you're in and kind of things like that.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm still based in Northumberland. I do travel fairly regularly. I do locally. I'm probably doing two days a week now because I want to ride my horse the rest of the time. I had a couple of health problems over the last couple of years, and it gave me a real sharp kind of point on what's important. And I absolutely love what I do, and I want to keep doing what I do. But I also kind of focus on other things that I was worried about, if that makes sense. So I make sure I ride my horse and spend time with my family. And we do, I do sort of 2 days a week, and I go down to Windsor and Ascot and do some ex-Rockley rehabs and things down there every quarter. And then I've got sort of Edinburgh-ish run up north, and then a Yorkshire run, North Yorkshire run. And other than that, I'm quite happy just plodding along on sort of 2 days a week. And that also now gives me the pressure off that if I need to see something urgently or if a new interesting case comes in or something like that, I have a lot more free time just to sort of almost drop everything and go, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And I kind of found out about you. I mean, this is like 10 years ago or more now because of Rockley Farm. And so you still, you know, for those that might not know, I mean, I hope if they hear the podcast, they know where Rockley Farm is. Yeah. It's a navicular rehab in the UK. But you still work on some horses at Rockley or who have graduated from Rockley?
No, who have graduated from, and they're probably sort of 5-10 year graduates, some of them, you know, even more maybe. I'm not sure how long I've been going down to that area, but yeah, it's frightening where time just disappears. Yeah, no, I was probably last down there when Nick was writing the Performance Horse book. I went down to kind of for a few days just to brainstorm some ideas and things and help with it a little bit. But we're well overdue a catch up, and we keep saying to each other we really need to catch up. So I think I'm going to make a point of that. That's kind of another prod for me to sort that out.
Yeah. And I mean, I feel the same. Like I kind of check in with her every once in a while. And she's really the reason that I got into hoof care and got into a passion for navicular rehab. And
She needs bottling.
Yeah, exactly. And honestly, like, you know, I don't think I would have a track system facility now if I hadn't gone to visit Nick in 2015, out at Rockley Farm, and she's just a huge inspiration. But
I think the place actually has to be, until you see it, you can't really understand how good it is. The, you know, the different surfaces, the way the horses have to move around to see other parts of the valley and things like that. It's a very special place, I think, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I would love to talk a little bit about navicular today too, if you're up for it.
Yep,
I mean,
absolutely.
Obviously there's so many hoof issues that we could talk about or just hoof interests and, you know, philosophies, ideas, but navicular is sort of where it all started for me. So do you still work on a lot of navicular cases? Is that sort of a big part of your...
Yeah, that's a big... Yeah, it's to be honest, it's kind of what excites me. Laminitis, we all as hoof care people have to deal with it, but I find it with a heavy heart when people ring and they need some help with that, because you're dealing with obviously metabolic issues and all that sort of thing, and you're really limited on how much you can help without medication and without, you know, getting the really hard to explain. But with navicular, I see it's a lot personally, I think you can give quite a bit more as a hoof care provider, because you can deal with how the horse is moving, you can see how the horse is moving, and you can change and help and advise in that. So yeah, that's when people ring the navicular case, I'm still 20 years down the line, I still get quite excited to help. It immediately switches my keen button on, my light comes on, and I'm really interested. Yeah, so when people phone that first phone call, that's really important, because they're obviously, they found you, they've sought you out for a reason, and you've got to kind of get as much information out of them as possible to make sure you can help. I do try initially find out when it first started, because, you know, navicular is a catch-all term. It's a pain in the back of the foot. You know, it can be caused, pain in the back of the foot can be caused by thrush, you know, poor frogs, poor, you've got to get, try and take an onion skin, peel it back and find out if there's a simple solution first, and then find out where they're at, what the team's been doing, you know, what have they tried so far. And then I always ask for an iPhone video and a picture so I can see what I'm looking at, and I tend to slow it down. I've got a really good app. It's a coaching app for baseball, I think, in golf, but it allows me to slow it right down, zoom in, I can mark it up and things, and it's better than, I don't like the slow-mo videos that you do. I find that you can't read, it doesn't work for me for watching. I don't know if there's something in the system where it's slightly smooth sort of slides out or whatever, but if you take a standard video and slow it down frame by frame, I think you can see the landing. Basically what I'm looking for is how the horse is landing. I'm assuming if I ring in navicular, pain in the back is probably toe first, and that's when my brain starts to work as to how can I get this, what's the simplest way for it to land heel first. Because you're not going to improve anything. You're not going to improve anything until you get your horse landing heel first. And I try and explain it so people can. I think I see in pictures, my brain's a bit odd, but I try and explain it in ways like if I was talking to a new owner about why we need to get them heel first, if you think of the toe up and the heel down, everything's sort of preloaded and pre-stressed. So it's under load already when it hits the ground, and then moves, the horse moves through the stance phase, moves over its foot. Where when they're toe first, you've got that load and becomes a lot more impact, a lot more instant pressure. It's like if you have two cars, you tie them together with a rope, you drive the front car off without building the tension up, the rope will probably snap.
Yeah.
If you tie those same two cars together with bale of twine, build that pressure up slowly with the front car, that the back car will creep and you'll get the car to tow without snapping. Even it's that sort of analogy I use. You're trying to get the horse to use the structures how it should. I mean, it's not just me. You know, yourself, there's like Rooney and Denoir have all done research back in the past. And it's trying to make that understandable to people.
Yeah, actually, I just did a podcast episode, not for my podcast, oddly enough, but for the Hoof to Horse one, with a few friends, and we talked about heel first landings. And Lisa Aegis Gilbert, she's going to make fun of me for not knowing how to say her last name, but she actually said almost the exact same thing, that like when the soft tissue in the back of the limb is at full tension, it's actually at its best ability to disperse all of the ground reaction forces and, you know, the basically the impact up the limb, because at full tension it's sort of at its peak, you know, shock absorbing ability.
It's not getting a surprise. It's already loaded. It's braced for it. It's probably the way of putting it. Yeah.
Right.
And when it comes to rehab and that, I find that's the hardest part and most interesting. A horse will do what's most comfortable to do. You can't explain to them. You can't say, look, you need to, I know it's a bit sore, but you need to land heel first to get this to improve. You have to make it the easy way for them to do it. And conformable surfaces is the best way. I mean, if I could find someone who could bottle wet sand on the end of a tide line on beach, that's perfect. Rockley's pretty close, I think, sometimes. Because I'd rather they did it that way. You know, then you do the leading out and you build the work up and things once they're comfortable. I try not to have anything on painkillers and things if possible, because I don't want them to do too much. You know, I don't. The more you do when they're not. Actually, I keep talking about Nick, but Nick, there's something that, there's a few people say things as your career and you remember them right the way through. And I remember Nick saying to me, movement's imperative, it's good, but it's only good movement is good. And that's the best way I can describe it. They need to be landing heel first. Otherwise, you're just compounding the problem. And it's that little bit of onion skin research, detective work as to why is this horse. So you put the team around it, you kind of, you know, the body workers are really important. A really good body work and can tell you where stuff's tight, but they don't always release it because they think it's a compensation, you know, rather than everybody working individually, you all have to work together. And like, just leave it this week, you know, walk them out a bit longer and then try. And that kind of thing is just nursing the horse back to being that slow of course. I mean, you do have boots and pads. I tend to be guarded with them. If they can't find a conformable surface to work on, or even working on a night, you know, softer grass. At the minute, everywhere's rock hard over here. Then boots and pads. But you have to be really kind of disciplined on how much time you do, because I think, again, that allows the foot to do more than it's capable of doing.
Yeah. And actually, I was going to ask about that, because I use, you know, when I have horses that come to my track system, I do use boots and pads until I feel like they're comfortable moving over the different surfaces. Mm-hmm. But I know at Nick's, when I went there, you know, what, 11 years ago now, she said that she felt when she was using boots that she didn't see the feet improve as quickly as when they were moving over. I mean, she definitely has a lot of conformable surfaces, like you said.
Yeah.
But she didn't see the feet improve as much as when they were barefoot on the track, which I totally understand, because the boot is that layer of protection where it's not able, the foot isn't able to contact the ground and the different surfaces itself. But is that something that, you know,
it's part of the reason that I don't, it's not the first line of, the horse has to be comfortable. And, you know, every doesn't matter what we think, the horse kind of, the horse, how the horse is feeling trumps what we want to do. But if you can get, if I want as much done as possible without boots, I would like the work in hand done without boots, to find a grass feel. You know, a horse shouldn't be in boots 24/7. I don't feel it's, I think you will struggle to get improvement then. If they need boots on to do a little bit of road work, to, you know, hand walking, if that's the area they've got to do that hand walking, you have to kind of cut your cloth to it's no good telling somebody you need to do this, this and this and this if they live in the middle of a built up area and all they've got is X, Y and Z. So you have to, your job as a hoof care provider really is to see what they've got and make the best of it and help them make a plan to use what they've got. But yeah, boots and pads. Certainly I wouldn't ever use a boot without a pad in. It's not about, to me, it's not about reducing the concussion by putting a pad in. It's about increasing the dynamic pressure back, you know, so the foot is getting pressure, you know, it falls into collateral grooves and all that sort of thing. So the foot's getting pressure back through the pad rather than just being on a flat surface.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I tend to use quite simple. My preference initially, and again, this is my personal preference, is I prefer boots like Cavello's with no straps around the back of the foot or anything like that. None of the straps going over the lateral cartilage or anything like that initially. And I don't know why, that's just what I've always preferred. And also the fitting is more generous in them than some of the sportier type boots. So you can, hey, you've got a bit more space to manipulate pads and through, because the feet always change, you know, that's what we want. And again, it's just trying to, you know, eventually ideally the toe will come back, but I'm not into trying to force the shape onto the foot. You have to help it along, certainly help it along, but initially I want the horse to become comfortable with what it's got, and we gradually sort of help it and nudge it. And that's part of the bigger picture of getting it through the first sort of 6 months. Once they're happy to, you know, they're back under saddle walk, you know, walking out, that's when you can start doing a little bit more and seeing where they're at.
Yeah.
But the hardest part, the sort of picture of a roller coaster going up, you know, to get them over the top is the hardest bit. And that is getting the heel first landing back.
So and what are usually your like first steps, like when you meet a new horse? I know that, you know, you've already talked to the owner, you've looked at their movement on video, yes, and then obviously in person. So what are some things that you do to try to get to getting that horse closer to a heel first landing?
Yep. So the absolute first thing I do is I don't even care what the frogs look like. I assume the thrushy or there's something, and I basically give, particularly if they've been shod, they seem to do less, but people who are already barefoot seem to have already on board with the frog sprays, the you know, the red horse, the horse leads, all that sort of branded sprays and stuff. I tend to always initially get them strong salt water twice or three times a week as well, and get them to really work on the frog health. Have a look at the diet, you know, check any metabolic issues, how the horse is landing, is the saddle, you know, what was the saddle like, has it got ulcers? Has it, you know, has the vet found any arthritic changes? Just looking for reasons and things that gives us something to work on that we can mitigate reasons from, if that makes sense. Because you've got to pick it apart. You know, the horse is one thing. You know, it could have six or seven different things wrong, but one of those things is what's breaking the straw that's breaking the camel's back that the horse can't cope with. So you pick that off first, get it back to where it was, and then try, you know, help with every other thing you find as you go. That's just like an onion skin, the best way. You sort of peel them back, and one thing normally shows you the next. And that's where I'm really keen to have really good body work. I'm lucky here now. I've been doing it so long. You know which horses suit which people, and which, you know, there's a lot of personalities. You have to put the person, the right personality, ideally as well, with the right person. So, you know, some people need a lot of details. Some people just need a little bit of help. Don't want the horse helped, and it, you know, a lot of details too much for them. They just need very simple instructions. Where some people want to know why every decision's been made, and you need to put the right people together as well. Yeah. Sort of orchestrating a team, but once you get through that bit, then everybody has to keep talking. I know I irritate people when I ask them to go and see a horse. I want to speak to them before I ask the client to ring them, they book them in. I say the client, ask them to give me a call before they go. They always do, they phone me, and I'm on the phone for half an hour, and I say, give me a ring after, and then I'll tie them up for another half an hour afterwards, because I've got stuff in my, you know, questions I want answered once I've seen the horse. It's just part of being keen to get it. You know, I'm not ashamed of it. I'm really, when I take a horse on, I want that horse back doing what it was before, or, you know, at least comfortable. And if we don't all talk, we're going to miss something. So I'm really pushy on people talking. I tend not to bother the vets much. I tend to drop them an email and say, this is where we're at. Are you comfortable? Because, you know, you can't, what I found back in the day, I think we kind of made them. I used to make a mistake of, you go and do it, you get the information, they've had an MRI, everybody jumps in and does it, then nobody really tells the vet how they're getting on. So yeah, I try and make a point of keeping everybody. I tend to do vets by email, but the body workers I tend to really annoy, and I want a phone call about it, because I want to ask them how stuff feels and stuff like that.
No,
it's just trying to find that the first thing, and you'll see the improvement, and then you kind of pick the other things around it, and then the compensations drop away as well. If you know, that block down with that tight on the right hand side, well, in the saddle sits to one side, but that's because, you know, they were sore on this shoulder or something like that, or they've got really bad thrush, so they've been landing toe first, and that's why they're tripping, and they're sore behind the sacroiliac, and they're not stepping through, or they're walking on a tightrope sort of platen in front and things. And it's just about picking what you need to do, and do you need to do something with the feet, or can the feet do it themselves, and then you help them along. Sometimes you have to interfere a bit more, well, you know yourself, sometimes you look at the foot and think, I need to do this. But what I want to know is, before I do it, is that a symptom or a cause? Because what you don't want to do is change medial-lateral balance, and then they've got a tight shoulder, loosen the shoulder, and then you've taken everything away, because that horse will then land medial-lateral until that grows back. So you have to be really sure what you're taking away. So I'm probably a bit slow in doing it. I mean, I have interfered in the past, but I tend to try and get the horse to walk out and wear its feet. That's another reason I don't really use boots. I want to see the wear myself, to see the wear pattern, and then you try and help that wear pattern along.
Yeah, absolutely. I know, that's another thing that's true, is that, so you mentioned that if they're tight, do you see that they land harder laterally or wear laterally? You're saying if they're tight in their shoulder?
As a rule of thumb, if it's something like sort of kissing spines, sort of just behind the saddle, and they tend to land medially and blow medial flares in front, lateral flares behind. That's just something I've seen. It's not always, it's just a rule. When I look at it, I think, oh, well, let's get, see if it can find anything up there or whatever. If I landed laterally in front, platen, it's tendency weakness in sort of sacroiliac, or just be, again, high up, just behind the saddle. I don't know why, I'm not a vet. It's not for me to diagnose. Just when I see it, that's where the body workers, and they tend to find something around those areas. Whether it's because I'm kind of steering that I think that, I don't, you know, we can all find stuff if we look for it, but that's generally what I see, and it seems to work. If you think of the foot like a balloon, where you put the pressure, it grows away. You know, mechanical flare will run away from that. If that horse is still landing reasonably level, but it's platen, and then you take that edge off to straighten the foot up, it'll start rolling. You're then loading the collateral ligaments as well. because one's pulling tight the same way we talk about when we tow a car. The tow car analogy is the same thing. One will twang tight. So it's about being sure why something's there before you do anything. I think that's the biggest thing on navicular, because it is just a catch-all term. You can have some awful x-rays with the arthritis and actually it's not that. It's something else. It's just they've tweaked the DFT or something like that. Yeah, it's just trying to be sure what you're doing before you do something.
Yeah. And you get a lot of horses that you see an MRI as well, like where you know that there are soft tissue issues or DDFT or collateral ligament damage, or is it mostly horses that they're just suspecting that that might be the case, but you don't have the advance?
I'll be honest, it's becoming more when someone phones you, they've had an MRI.
Yeah. That's amazing.
It seems to be that it's a lot more common. It's seeing, obviously the covered insurance thing, I don't know how insurance works over with you guys, but they tend to get a year to do everything, so they throw everything at it in the year. I've often thought insurance would be better if they did 2-year policies. And so, some horses just turn them away for 6 months on a hill somewhere, let them, settle down and, look after them, but give them time off for 6 months, where I think that's a bit more difficult when you're looking at insurance for, the price of MRIs and things, because they've got a year to fit everything in, and all of the PRP or IRAP or stem cell stuff. They've only got the year to do it.
Yeah.
So that's if I ever get to change one thing in horses, I'd like to change the fact that insurance is on a yearly. I'd wish it was on 2. So I think the insurance companies would make a lot more money, because most claims would just disappear if the horse actually gets some time to, most vets would probably say the same. I think that, to give them some time to, in fact, go to the doctors or the sore elbow, the first thing I don't get is he'll say, go to physio or something, come back in 6 months and we'll give you a steroid injection in your elbow. If it's still there, they don't do it the day you walk in.
Right.
But on insurance, you've only got sick, you've got your year to get everything through or your claims, then everything's excluded the next year. So everybody claims for everything, spend up their £8,000 limit or whatever, where a 2-year policy would, the first year or the first 6 months, they can turn them away. It doesn't cost them anything. And some horses will just come right within that and they'll not need to do everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And so do you have horses that, do you ever encounter vets that, might not be psyched about the fact that the owner is, going to pull shoes or turn them away or try something different than the corrective shoeing or wedges?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So how do you handle that?
Open and honest conversation. You tell them what you think. Vets will trump what you want to do. If they decide it's up to the owner. It's not a welfare issue. As in, if you're going to actually cripple a horse pulling a set of shoes off it for the sake of pulling the shoes off, then fair enough. But if they've tried the shoes and the wedges and nothing, that's the two I'd like to get in before they start everything or after they've done it, because then they've tried it, it hasn't worked. Let's try something else. And at some point, the money runs out as well. People can't just keep paying. So I think you have to talk about it. And most vets are quite open if you talk to them. I think if someone goes off on their own and tries to go across what they want, rightly so, they're responsible. You've got to behave professionally. If you behave professionally and speak to somebody, I don't really ever have a problem.
Yeah.
But I think it's communication again. It's talking to everybody. People... Everybody has the same goal. Nobody does something deliberately to make things worse. Everybody's goal is to get that horse better. And there's many roads lead to Rome, and actually there can be 3 right roads. You can kind of all 3, you can have ideas and you can all be right. Some horses shod with wedges do get a bit better. Personally, I don't think it lasts that. I do think my honest opinion is if you rehab them barefoot, you've got much more chance of getting back to the performance level you were at before.
Right.
Before the injury or whatever happened. But again, that's my personal opinion. I know Nick did some stuff, I think it was Project Dexter it was called, and one of the horses sort of quantified what she'd done. I think she was on quite a high, I don't want to say the number because I can't actually remember off the top of my head exactly what it was, but it was a lot higher than you would sort of think it would be.
I know. I remember it was above 80% where the horses went back to the same level of work or higher than before they went lame. And I guess
it's 85. I've just had a quick look on one of my laptop things, it was 85%. Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember, I mean, I still have that page saved from her blog. And I guess another question, you know, when I met Nick and when I was talking to her, one of the things that she had mentioned was some of the hardest cases that she got in for rehab, or ones that she just didn't feel were successful in rehab, or ones that had been already on NSAIDs or some kind of pain relief and worked despite the lameness. You know, they had somebody that was masking the lameness and they went on to work, because then it caused repetitive strain, repetitive injury, you know, chronic re-injury that basically made
too much
damage. Is that true? Did you still see that too? Because I feel like a lot of times what we do in terms of like a barefoot approach, a track system, whatever, ends up being sort of the last resort, the last approach. And so a lot of these horses have gone through the ringer. They have had injections and NSAIDs and corrective shoeing and all this other stuff. And I think that, you know, when I first started 10 years ago, I had some cases where I had horses come up sound within the first cycle, the first 4 to 8 weeks, and all of a sudden they were fine. And then, you know, I had a bunch of cases like that. And then now I feel like I end up getting a lot of cases where the owners have sort of done everything else for years, and then they're handing me this horse that's so broken, and they're like, "Fix it." And I'm like, "Well, I mean,
you can't fix them. Yeah, you can't fix them all. And mentally, you've got to kind of, it takes a long time to come to that in your head, as you say. But you've got to kind of, you can only do your best with them, and you know, that's why I said earlier, you know, having a horse on painkillers worries me. I don't want them in the field on painkillers. I don't, just until it's better. It's not because I'm sure it allows them to do more than they can. Obviously, the welfare comes first. If they need it, they need it, if it's a welfare issue. But I'd rather they were kind of, I'd rather something hurt as them do a bit more and then damage it completely.
Right.
That's the whole idea of pain, isn't it, really? It stops you damaging something further. It tells you there's something not right, and it needs to heal and to be careful with it. I've got a whole new respect for it since I tore all the tendons on my ankle a couple of years ago walking the dog, and every now and again I'm still aware of it, and I remember how much that hurt if I moved it wrongly. But you have to get through that and do the physio and walk through it. And you know, I was kind of thinking, if I was a horse, what would we do now? I'd probably have a lot more injections. I'd probably be better looked after.
I was actually just talking to a client today about that, because 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago now, I fell off a horse and tore my MCL in my knee. And just this last week, for some reason, I don't know why, it's been achy. And not achy so much that I can't work or can't walk or can't do my job. But I was just thinking about how many horses I see, or you see, or you know, any of us healthcare providers work on, that have some sort of ligament injury that a few years, you know, down the road, they still feel it in some way, because, you know, a ligament, it's very difficult to get a ligament back to where it was before. I mean, it's not a very stretchy structure.
No, well, they're a stay apparatus, aren't they? They're not really, they're not meant to.
Right.
I see them as rigging on a ship, you know, it's there to keep everything up and stable, you know, and stable. And yeah, I say it struck me. I was walking the dogs again. It was a couple of miles. I remember the thought coming across. I was walking across the hillside with the dogs, and it started to ache. And I thought, that's 2 years now. And, it's still strong. I ride my horse. I ride for an hour and a half at a time up in the hills here. And it's, you know, I can walk the dogs all day. And then all of a sudden, for no apparent reason, I started to feel this ache. And I did actually cross my mind. I says, you fix these horses, and they do have days when they're not quite right. And I'm thinking, well, maybe it's the same for them as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, the longer I do this, and it's, you know, I still consider myself new in the hoof care world, even though I've been doing this for 10 years, it's in the relative scheme of hoof care, it's, you know, newer. And the longer I do this, I realize, and I don't know if it's just that I'm recognizing more lameness or what, but I feel like, just like with people, I don't know how many horses are 100% sound. And I'm talking about not just, I'm not saying like, I don't want people to hear that and be like, oh my goodness, Alicia has all these lame horses and none of them are sound. I mean that like anywhere I go to a horse show, I go to, you know, wherever, anywhere I go and I see horses that I don't work on, horses in shoes, horses barefoot, horses on a trail ride, horses at barns that I go to that I don't work on, horses that I do work on. And I just see so many little things that maybe I wouldn't have picked up before, like the way that they, I mean, obviously landing and loading, like how they're landing hoof care wise, but even just how they adjust their stride, going uphill or downhill, or like, you know, if they get pushed away from a hay, the hay that they're on and going to the next hay. It's just, I notice these little things that I don't think I would have noticed before. And I think it's so funny that we focus so much on having a horse that's 100% sound. And I don't know any person that's 100% sound. I don't
know. I was going to say, walk down a main shopping street in, you know, in Newcastle or London or wherever, and just, or have a coffee and look at people. There's not many people don't walk with some limp or a slight turn out of their foot or a slip. Very few people walk like they're walking down a catwalk. I mean, if they do, they're probably the exception and they'll get stared at. But generally, most people have got a limp or have got something not quite right. And you've got a kind of serviceably sound was a term I don't really like, because it sort of says that you're riding a lame horse. You're not. It's kind of, I would rather, you know,
you're working within their
limits. Yeah, with the limitations. Same with people often ask me, oh, you know, when they come sound again, they are riding them again. Can I jump again? It's like, well, let's just do pleasure ride. Let's get you up to a year. If you give me a year of soundness, then, you know, stepping over poles is different. But if, you know, if you've had someone who's been a show jumper, they've had a problem, you know, an injury, my gut feel is always, well, look, you've got your horse, you're hacking it, you're riding it. If jumping's that important to you, you know, you're putting that risk, you're putting all of that weight, all of, you know, through that. We know the horse is comfortable now. I'm always really guarded on jumping afterwards. But if they want to do it, I put a mark in the sand that you want at least a year's soundness first, doing everything you want to do, bar the jumping. And if you're still sure, then, you know, start slow and make sure the surfaces are 100% right for you. No, you know, not too deep or not too hard or...
Right.
But that always, it does... Yes, they've been a good show jump, and yes, you want them back to where they were, but that's the kind of, I always worry about, maybe to be thankful for what you get back sometimes as well.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, I think that it's amazing how resilient, or really how well a lot of these horses can put up with, one, what we ask of them, but two, you know, healing from things that we kind of do to them. And I hate to say that, but we ask a lot of horses. People ask a lot of horses. And,
absolutely.
And I don't know, maybe I've gone soft in like 10 years of hoof care, but it's...
No, I think you do. I think you just, you because you see so much, you're probably like me, you know, you get a lot of phone calls. You take on everybody's kind of, you know, everybody loves the horse. Everybody loves the horse. Everybody wants it to be right. And when they're not right, it's horrendous, you know, for the owner as well as the horse. And you take on that as a hoof care provider, you take on that, you have that sense of responsibility to try and help, and you take on that emotional, it's taken me 20 years to learn how to, I remember Matthew said to me years ago, you need to leave it in the truck, mate. And it's easier said than done, because I don't, I still think about it. You know, wake up, if you're thinking about something, you wake up 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and think, I think that's what I'm trying to work out.
Was that Matthew Jackson?
Matthew Jackson, yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's been on the podcast.
Yeah, he's the reason I started.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, he's got full credit and responsibility for starting me up, yeah.
Oh, that's so great.
But I always remember that, because I rang him, I was worried about one. You need to leave him the truck, mate. And it's like, I do, but I need this fixed as well, or I can't, because I've got sort of brain that I need, you know, I need everything ticked off and I can't. But that's a real hard thing to learn, to be able to just, yeah, you're there to help, but you can't, no vet, no doctor can fix every person or every horse, and you have to kind of do your very best, but you get them back to, if I, you know, if the horse is lame and I get it back comfortable to be a pasture pet, I'm happy. I'm absolutely delighted when they're back on riding. You get a text to say, I've got my horse back. That's the best text you'll ever get. And every time you get one, it still feels the same as the first time you got one 20 years earlier.
Yeah. Which actually, I mean, I would love to hear if you have a case that you can share that you feel like is one of your favorite cases in terms of rehab that you worked on, that you feel like was a good outcome. Do you have one that you want to share?
It's going back. It's one of my early ones. But you know, when the early ones that kind of make a difference, try and find the... Yeah, it was a horse called Earl. He was a cob. I've just got one second. I've just got
on my laptop. I'm actually on O'Neill. Yeah, he was typical navicular. He was classed as about 2/10 layman right front and 4/5 layman a circle. He had nerve blocks and the lameness was located in the front right foot, in the abnormalities in both navicular bones on the x-rays. The initial recommendation, I'm going back, this is probably, it'll be 2009-ish, something like that, 2008, it's a long time ago. But their recommendations were Tildren steroid injections, remedial fiery egg bars and wedge pads, and that would give a guarded prognosis for passenger soundness. So the owner wasn't happy with that. I mean, I'm still not comfortable with Tildren because of the longer term effects. Then sort of five months later, I got a text. I'll just read the text. I've got it on the screen here. Thanks, Steve. You've been a source of information, encouragement, and all font of all things Barefoot. I don't think we've got this far without being top of it all off. Earl's qualifier for the Great Yorkshire next year and Equifest this year. So he was back out showing within 5 months.
Wow.
And I've always stuck that. Yeah, that was, and he's still going 8 years later. He's passed on now, but I mean, he was a good age when he did. He was back out, you know, hunting, and I think he even made it to a wedding as well. So that was great.
That's amazing. So yeah, what do you think was the biggest parts of his success in terms of rehab? Was it just, you know,
activating the back of the foot? Activating the back of the foot.
Like barefoot movement or?
Yeah, moving the shoes, getting the frog health right. And then he did use boots initially, I think, from memory. It's a long time ago. I think he did use boots initially because they're quite a stony sort of yard. But yeah, it was just keep him going, a minimal intervention on the balance, just let him be where he wanted the foot to be. And it was simple as that. And they put the work in, you know, the leading out in hand and then the riding out, you know, regularly building that plateau in it. Yeah. And I think it was just last year he passed on, and that was, you know, he's a good age.
Yeah. That's amazing. I mean, it's so great when it just seems like all they needed was that little nudge to get them to use their foot correctly. And then everything else sort of just, like all their, like you were saying, the compensations, they all kind of unravel. And then you have this more even horse, this stronger horse, their feet get stronger, their body gets more comfortable.
It's getting over that roller coaster on the top. Once everything starts rattling down the hill, things become a lot easier. That's the best way to describe it, is you get that. It's like a eureka moment. Once you find out why you can't get them healed first, get that. And sometimes, you know, they've done a serious injury, they need time to heal. You know, you have to bear that in mind as well. You just have to kind of look at every horse on its individually and see what you can do. And the stuff, you know, while it's healing, you're getting the frogs right. While it's healing, you're sorting the body work out while it's healing. So, you know, you're not just waiting, you are doing stuff in the meantime, but you're probably not until whatever the inflammation or the injury is, or, you know, that's where you're. But I mean, I have seen horses toe first landing, seen as navicular cases, and we sorted the frogs out, we sorted the thrush out, we sorted sheared heels out, and surprisingly that everything else disappeared. You know, they still have changes in x-rays and they still have changes in the foot. But you could x-ray 20 horses and they'll have changes in the foot, but actually they're okay, they're coping. And frog health is one takeaway is frog health is your biggest, you know, if it wasn't supposed to touch the ground, it wouldn't grow on the only part of the horse that touches the ground. So your frog needs to be good. You know, it's there for a reason, and that's something that we can do. It's something tangible that we can help with.
Right. I know. And I think that it's so hard. I mean, in terms of, like you were saying, finding that thing that sort of sets it off to get them comfortable. And sometimes that can take, I don't know if you've had times where it just takes so long to figure out why they're not landing comfortably and able to engage the back of the foot.
Yep. Yeah. It's hard. And they're the ones that you sit up at night thinking about. They're the ones that you go back to time and time again. You're scrubbing the, you know, you're saying, are you scrubbing these? Yep, they are. And you can look and see they're doing everything. And then nobody has x-ray eyes. Sometimes they do heal. You know, if they have got a tweak or a tear or something like that, the time and the movement. But obviously movement while they're doing that, controlled movement is good. You know, you don't want stuff to heal just the scar tissue. You want them moving so it heals properly. And that's when I kind of make that judgment, again, talking about boots and pads or without. It's that kind of, we discussed it, the pros and cons of it. And then I'm kind of a bit OCD about sending me a, you know, weekly check. I, with the navicular ones, if I start and work out, I will check in with them weekly. And I've got time to do that now, which is, I enjoy doing it. So I'm, it's not a, what are you doing? Let's make sure you're doing it right. It's to make sure they're not doing too much or they're not. Because it's quite easy once to start doing 15 minutes, do 20 and then half an hour. And it's that plateau. You know, if they're doing half an hour, I want them doing half an hour for 3 weeks. And then if they're building up to 40 minutes, that's fine. But if they do that 40 minutes for another 3 weeks, you know, the horse, everything has to build up slowly. Once you get past 2 hours, I think I'm quite comfortable. They can do what they want. But
yeah. Is that all in terms of like when you're talking about 20 minutes, 30 minutes, is that all tack walking?
Walked or led from another initially.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they're comfortable doing that, you know, if you're doing it three times a week, the middle ones maybe is a ridden session.
Okay, yeah.
After four weeks, you know, you'll do 3 weeks in hand, and then if they're still comfortable, still as comfortable when they come back as when they go out, great jump. You know, the middle session is a ridden one. It's not as long, but it's a ridden one, and then you up the walking time before you up the ridden time. Because I do believe you've got to, you know, actually having the weight on the horse move differently, the move into pressure and having to carry and stuff is actually, you can ask them to carry themselves a little bit better. Without forcing them, but yeah, you can. But that's also harder work for them, so you have to do less of that initially.
Yeah, yeah, and I don't know if you well, obviously you haven't been to my farm, but I literally bought my farm because it reminded me of Nick's property. It's very hilly. We have a driveway that's nearly a mile long, and mm-hmm. it reminded me of sort of where Nick would tack rock her rehabs and pony some of the horses, and I was like, oh, this will be great.
I think that's the difference between I'm going back from the very when I started barefoot was a bit weird, and then it's become normal. Track systems thankfully become normal, you know, the horse moves and things like that. But I think there's a difference. I think you'll probably agree there's a big difference between a track system and rehabbing a horse in a track system. Just putting a horse in a track system, yes, it encourages movement, but Nick does so much more than that as well. You know, and that's what I learned from her is how much, and that's it's a gift of an eye she's got. And, you know, I don't know how you replicate that, but, you know, when the horse is ready, it's led out. When the horse is ready, it's ridden out. And there's also straightness, sort of the straightness training sort of stuff, you know, in-hand work in the school, posture work and all that sort of thing. You know, it's not just walking around a track saying, oh, we're a rehab facility. There's actually physical work put in with that horse.
Right.
That horse has a plan for the 12 weeks it's there, or however long, 8-12 weeks, however long Nick's sort of stays are.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the horse goes home to be, you know, and then the rehab is continued. You know, you know, I don't think she's ever said you hand back a completely fixed horse. You hand back a sound horse that can go out and do stuff. But then it's down to the owner to keep that work going and keep that strength building and build on that good movement, which is what the track and all Nick work creates, is the good movement, is that heel first. And I think that's the benefit. That's when we talk about trying to force that heel first. I think it comes better with those sort of track systems where the horse is moving and it's comfortable, it's a conformable surface. It becomes the most comfortable way for the horse to move.
Yeah. And I think that something, one of the biggest things too I learned from her is that, you know, once these horses are sound, or once they're sounder, they're back ridden, they really, and correct me if I'm misunderstanding, but they really should stay in some work and stay fit to not fall back into those old patterns, old, you know, lameness issues because of compensations. Yes. So you have to keep that horse, you know, moving correctly and working essentially.
But you should enjoy doing that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that shouldn't be the chore. That's the pleasure you've got. That's like you're getting to the top of the mountain, but you don't want to sort of summit and take your picture, take a selfie at the top.
Yeah.
You know, that's to me, if I said to somebody who phoned me in tears to say the horse the MRI, it's this, and this, got a prognosis for pasture soundness, can you help? Yes, blah, blah, blah. If I says, okay, well, you can keep it sound if you ride it 5 days a week, you know, and walk and, you know, and a little bit of walking up hills and do pull work once a week out of the 5 days, something like that, they'd take your arm off for that.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I'm a great believer in them. I mean, that's kind of one of the reasons I ride 5 days a week. You know, with hills here, he walks, he doesn't do, I don't do a lot of fast work because he's a big, heavy horse. And we don't, you know, I'm not that interested in it. But we do, you know, we have the canter across the top of the hills and stuff like that. But it is about grunt work, walking up and down hills and, you know, I don't want to jinx anything, but I think that's, you know, the fitter a horse is, and physically fit, and I mean from a point of view of walking, done, you know, not just cardio fit, not just wind fit, a bit of gallop for a long time, but actually physically fit, walking and walking and walking and moving, then you got more chance of keeping that horse sound into older age.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I see that same with horses that, you know, aren't even navicular rehabs that I work on. I have horses that are in their late 20s being ridden, and I kind of ask the secret, and they're like, well, we've always been riding. It's just sort of like they're always
use
doing
it. Use it, yeah. Use it or leave it. Just keep going as long as the horse is happy. And yeah.
Right.
Because once you start losing that, you know, we all know the look of an older horse where they don't look skinny, but they look very poor. You know, they can't keep top line. Their back starts to sink and all that sort of thing. Once they get to that stage, at that age, you're not going to get that back. You know, you can't work them hard enough to get it. So you have to work them hard enough to keep it.
Right. Yeah. Awesome. I mean, I know that you have a dinner commitment, so I want to be where, you know, acknowledge
your time. You're safer in front of a herd of cows trampling than me between me and my dinner. Yeah, you're right.
But I really appreciate you being willing to chat with me again. And I, you know, I would love to talk regularly if you have, you know, time to do that in the future. But this is, I mean, it's so nice to be able to talk to someone who has the same kind of, you know, approach. And obviously I love talking to people with different approaches because there's always more to learn, but it's always exciting to talk to people who sort of have gone through or are going through the same kind of things that I see every day. And it's really nice to learn.
It's good to talk to people about it because we take everything on mentally. You know, we've got our horses that we work with and you take responsibility for those, you know, so you've got all that pressure on you. And actually one of the big things I've learned is to talk to people about it. And you know, they have different ideas, but it doesn't mean that's certainly what I would say to anyone starting out, is to make sure you build a network of other trimmers and farriers that you can talk to and, you know, and chat about what would you do and what do you think of this. Or, and it does lift you a little bit because you can get stuck in. You know, it goes in phase. I don't know if yourself you notice it goes in phases of horses. You get two or three at a time that aren't going quite right. All of a sudden, you're going for ages saying everyone's happy, it's all great. And then you get two or three sort of snowballs and you're thinking about, you know, what can we do here? What's happened? It's good to have that network around you, farriers, trimmers, body workers, physios, that you can ring up and say, what do you think of this?
Yeah.
And it just takes a bit of pressure off you.
Right. Yeah, which reminds me, are you anywhere near where the Equine Podiatry Association conference is in October?
I'm thinking about it. I'm just trying to work out where I'm going to be. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'll be there and, you know, Paige Poss will be there. There's a whole bunch of people going, obviously, but it would be great to meet in person if you're around that area.
Yeah. We'll have a chat before you go. I'm sure we can sort something out.
Yeah. That'd be awesome. All right. Well, I will let you go. And I really appreciate your time and thank you for being willing to talk to me again.
No, good luck deciphering all of that brain dump anyway.
No, it's great.
Okey-doke. Thanks.
All right, well, have a great rest of your day.
Brilliant. Okey-doke. Cheers. Bye.
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 I always say that I'm slightly more hoof-obsessed than the average person, and chances are, if you're listening to a hoof care podcast, you are too, so we should probably be friends. Feel free to find me on Facebook or email me at thehumblehoof@gmail.com.